Welcome to the Matthew Moran Podcast. Here you will find a series of in-depth conversations with the world's best nature photographers, filmmakers, conservationist editors, writers, and publishers. You will get an insight into the lives of industry experts and the unsung heroes. What goes on in their minds, how they approach their work, and how they make it pay. The podcast also looks at the role that photography and filmmaking plays in helping to shine a light on the global plight of species. And, despite the depressing statistics, we look for solutions of what we can all do to contribute to conservation. All my guests give up their precious time and they are incredibly generous of spirit. Now I'm sharing these conversations with you. Please, you, share them with your community, get them out there. Every little bit helps. And that's what we really need right now. I really hope you enjoy this one. Thanks so much for listening. This week, I have the pleasure of hosting Chantel Lindsay as my guest. Hailing from South London, but with connections to Doncaster and Peterborough, Chantel is a versatile wildlife conservationist and TV presenter. And she is dedicated to making nature inclusive and accessible to everyone. Her goal is to instigate positive change within the environmental sector and beyond, aspiring to be a beacon of love and a force for good. She is passionate about inspiring and empowering underrepresented individuals to connect with nature and advocates for many organizations, including Flock Together, Black Girls Hike, and the London Wildlife Trust's own Keeping It Wild program. In this podcast, she candidly shares her own challenges and the tenacious journey she undertook to establish herself in the industry whilst dealing with her own issues of self-doubt. I'm so grateful for Chantel for speaking so openly. She's so warm and has a very generous spirit. And I'm sure you're really going to enjoy this. Quick note to say thanks to everyone who supported the podcast and my new Patreon page. If you'd like to help, you can contribute $5 per month by visiting patreon.com/Matthew Moran Podcast. The link is up on the podcast page of my website. And if you can't, please continue to share the podcast with your friends. Every bit helps. All right, here's Chantel. Chantel, welcome to my home studio in Tottenham. Thank you so much for taking the time to be here. And also, we spent a pretty cool day together hanging out. This has been more than just a podcast. I met Chantel this morning. We've been to Highgate Cemetery. We've done a photo shoot in Waterlow Park.
We've done it all.
We've had a nice dal lunch cooked for us by my partner, Ro.
Yep.
And we're finally here. And this is very exciting.
Thank you for having me. It's absolutely gorgeous here. If any of these listeners have ever been to Matt's house, you'll know how absolutely like love-filled it feels. And this studio is beautiful. So thank you for having me on.
Oh, it's very kind of you to say. No, it's a real pleasure. And, you know, especially I always make the joke for South Londoners coming north. You know, it's a big effort. So I'm really, really thankful for that. Yeah, it is.
I'm no stranger. We'll talk about this later on, but I'm no stranger to the north now. So a bit more comfortable with it.
Yeah.
So yeah, yeah. I can come here and feel okay.
It's not bad up here, is it?
No, it's not too bad. It's really great.
No, that's great. And yeah, like I said, we've spent a bit of time together. When one of the great things about doing that is just getting a little bit more comfortable. We probably will repeat some of the things that we said. That's totally fine.
Yeah.
For the listeners.
And that we've already met on. The first time that we met, I was interviewing Matt.
That's right. Yeah. And I'm glad you said that because now the roles are reversed. And it's actually what's really good fun, listeners, is watching a presenter be really nervous about being interviewed, which Chantel's been all day.
That is me.
Yeah. It's great. It's like, haha.
Yeah.
Yes. I'm in charge.
Anxiety. That should be coined in the dictionary because I'm sure it's an absolute thing.
It's amazing. And it's brilliant because, yeah, Chantel mentioned interviewing me and Rachel when we were doing our presentation at the Natural History Museum, at the lovely Natural History Museum. How lucky were we?
But, stunning.
Yeah, it was great. And we really clicked. And I was so thankful that you wanted to come on the podcast and we're here now. And so, yeah, I wanted to dig in deep, find out a bit more about you. Obviously, I've been doing a bit of research about you over the last few days.
And, a bit of research. Matt is an expert on me now.
I know, diving in. And no, it's great. It's one of the things I really love about the podcast is, yeah, just finding out about people. And that's the whole point of it, is also sharing you with my audience and people who don't know who you are. So let's start. Let's find out like who you are, who you are. Obviously, these are all my podcasts are natural history focused. Yeah. You are a presenter among many other things, mm-hmm. wearing hats. You're currently working part-time with the London Wildlife Trust. And I mean, yeah, you've done so much already in your tender years. But yeah, how did it all start for you? How did you get into wildlife and nature in general?
Yeah, well, I was listening to your podcast this morning with Kabir. And very similarly, I don't feel like I had that penny drop moment of like one, I don't know, like huge thing that brought me into nature. For me, nature's always kind of felt like a soul purpose, just a soul calling. And it's just been, yeah, like ingrained in me. And for me, it started off with the focus on animals, which for a lot of us, I think it is. The fluffy things, the sexy things, the exotic things. but actually, I couldn't have my own pets when I was younger. So I used to just try and adopt other people's or strays, literally. I was born in Doncaster in South Yorkshire. And there was, we used to have a traveller neighbours across the road, and they used to have a dog. And I think they would just kind of use her for breeding. so I took it upon myself. I was like, right, I'm adopting her. So yeah, she used to like come across the road and I'd like feed her up and everything. And they knew that I was doing it. They were absolutely fine with it. But yeah, literally would just like adopt other people's pets and things like that. So yeah, it was the empathy that I've always been a very empathetic person. I am a very empathetic person. And so for me, it was, yeah, looking at an animal and going like, what are you trying to say? Like, what's the communication? Just being absolutely fascinated and in awe of animals and their behavior, why they do certain things, how they do certain things. And of course, we are just like, we are all nature, we are all animals. So it's just having that affinity with something non-human, which I always just loved. And it always just brought me a lot of peace. I always tell the story of like, you know, my mum can take some credit for it because she had like a safari wallpaper up in my room when I was younger. She's always been like my biggest cheerleader in terms of that. Like, even if she wasn't so much into pets, she had her own connection with nature. She was always, and we've always been really blessed and lucky to have a garden.
Great.
And so she'd always be in the garden, tending the garden. And that's the thing. I think everyone has got their own connection. She's not super. It's not super like obvious all the time because I feel like a lot of the time people put nature connection into a box. It's like you have to know the Latin, this and that.
Yeah, sure.
But it's not the way.
No, I mean, you just have to go into a park and to see the myriad ways that people connect with nature.
Exactly,
so
yeah.
So many different ways.
Exactly. So yeah, it was animals that it introduced, that brought me into the sphere. And I've been captured ever since. And just adding on to it, I think the more I've been immersed in it, you know, the love for fungi has come, the love for birds has come, for the soil, just for everything. And I think that's the beauty of wildlife. It's so expansive.
Yeah.
And so non-judgmental, it feels like. You can go out into nature and just feel super peaceful.
Yeah.
Like I said to you earlier as well, when we were doing the photo shoot, for me, when I come out into nature, it's like, sometimes, yeah, I might want to come out with a full face of makeup, but my like favorite time in nature is when I'm just like, I've got no makeup on and my hair might not be done. I might have just have like rolled out of bed, like, you know, just because nature will just embrace you as you are.
That's brilliant. And so your empathy and obviously huge curiosity about nature and love of animals also kind of caught your activist side when you were quite young. I was reading about you working or on behalf of PETA and being an activist at school when you're at secondary school. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, sure. So in secondary school, we had for RS, religious studies, I had an amazing teacher called Miss John. So big up to her if she's listening. I'll send this to her. And she really, I think that's the importance of teachers, you know, like who just nurture you and just people who will nurture you. Like my mom, you know, my sisters have always supported me with this.
Yeah, that can't be underestimated.
No,
can it?
Not at all. It's a community and that's, you know, you need your community. But yeah, so she, as a part of religious studies, we were taught about the meat industry vivisection, which is animal testing, fur industry, all of that. And I was just, and we used to just watch the most like horrific videos. And, you know, for some people, the shock factor isn't going to be the call to action. And it's very fluid. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. Sometimes you just want the cute and fluffy. But at that time, I was just so shocked. Like, this is actually going on in the world. I love animals. This is going on. What the heck is happening?
Yeah.
I don't want to be a part of that. So yeah, I had to get upon myself to do loads of like research. I was volunteering with PETA. Obviously they're a bit, you know, more on the extreme side. So yeah. It's not everything that they do that I agree with, but I was like volunteering with them and basically going around each year group and doing presentations on, I just took it upon myself to do presentations about, yeah, vivisection, the fur industry, and the meat industry and all of that sort of thing. Not necessarily preaching. I didn't want to be like preaching, but I just wanted to educate people.
Yeah, because, and that's what it's about, isn't it? It's about informing people.
Exactly.
Like, yeah, you can beat people over the head. I mean, I struggled. I've watched lots of those videos and I do struggle to watch them these days. I almost don't need to because yes. you know.
Mm.
But if, you know, we were talking earlier about also how humans are really good at compartmentalizing, you know, and that whole thing of, you know, we can love our cats and dogs, but then we go and have and eat cows and pigs, you know, there's just, how do you weigh that up? But we do, we're masters at it.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of stuff out there that people just don't know about. So exactly. If you can inform them and then make your decision
about
what you want to do with that, as long as you know. And so that's, it sounds like that's what you were, your aim and goal was when you were a young activist at school.
It was, yeah. Just to kind of bring people into the fold and just, it just started to like, you know, ripple out. And from that, I was awarded by Croydon Council this award for raising awareness about animal rights, which I just thought was so cool because they probably, that was like probably the first, I don't know, first ever award that they've given out for that. So I was just like, that's so amazing. I felt really honoured about that. But it was just, it's those little ripples that you make as well, because from that, we then, as part of the RS religious studies project that we did, we raised funds for boycotting KFC, Kentucky Fried Cruelty, back then I called it, or PETA called it.
That's a great name.
And so my friends helped me do that. I kind of like corralled them into doing it and they were on board. And so we raised money for that. And then I remember just going home and my mum's super open-minded at the time. She was researching like raw food diet. So she was like thinking about changing her diet anyway. And I just kind of went home and I was like, I'm a vegetarian, mum. And she was like, okay, cool. Let's all do it.
That's awesome.
But you know, like we were saying, you don't have to be like all or nothing. So she was like, hey, we don't know much about being vegetarian. Let's ease into it. So we're going to be pescatarian. So we were still eating fish at the time, which was another thing. Like I was like trying to reconcile, like for me, fish and meat, like, you know, fish and meat, fish and other animals, you know, they still feel the same pain, course, and things. So yeah. It was quite a hard thing to reconcile, but I was like, you know what, you're right. Let's not just go cold turkey. And I think that's so important for so many people, is that you don't have to just give it all up. Like,
yeah.
Even if you're just doing meatless Mondays, you know, like in an ideal world, in my like perfect world, we wouldn't eat animals. And
of course,
and,
yeah.
You know, but like, that's not
searching for perfection. We're on a kind of hiding to nothing, aren't we? Because it doesn't exist.
No.
Yeah. And I often cite Colleen Patrick Goodrow, this brilliant vegan advocate from California. And she said this great thing of basically, don't do nothing because you can't do everything. Mm-hmm. Just do something. And that does help. It does make a huge difference. And again, yeah. It's about being informed. Like, we know now. We know the cause, you know, the destruction of the environment caused by raising cattle. We know that, you know, more energy gets, you know, put into raising, and, you know, these animals and the amount of water that gets put in compared to the calories that come out, it just doesn't balance up. We know that. It's like unequivocal. So what can we do to change that? And it's just making like small adjustments. It doesn't have to be going the whole hog.
Yeah.
You know, if many, many people made small adjustments, it would make a huge difference.
Exactly. It's a team effort.
Yeah.
We have to all be in it together.
Totally. But, let's fast forward from you being a young activist to, you know, deciding what you were going to do for A-level and university. And, you know, I know that you becoming a presenter has kind of happened a little bit organically, but you do have to make those decisions. And again, we were talking earlier about this, you know, A-levels being a really, really hard time in, well, all of our lives. I really struggled with doing A-levels. That jump from GCSE to A-levels is really tough, but it's also really important because that's the gateway to university. And you studied sciences, right?
So,
you know, did you know at this moment in time that, you know, presenting was something that you might want to do, or work as a conservationist and do the sexy stuff like radio collaring lions and going tracking them in the jungle?
To be honest, I think I wanted to do it all.
Yeah.
but I think for me, the presenting, the media side of it was like, I had it in my head because David Attenborough, you've got the David Attenboroughs. It's very like old white man, like love David Attenborough, of course. But like I was seeing so much of like the same person doing it. So for me, it was like, oh, maybe later in life, you know, when I'm an old white man, that will happen some point. But no, yeah, like in serious, I thought like, you know, like it would be later in life, that I would just kind of like, yeah, give it a go, whatever. So it's always been there, the presenting side, but it hasn't been the driver. When I look back over my life, there were little indications that actually were preparing me for presenting, decisions that I'd made that were manifesting that my presenting career. But the real driver, the real bit that's in my heart space is my connection with nature. And I think it's super what I loved learning about in university, skipping ahead, spoiler alert, I went to university, was learning about conservation biology and how there's loads of different ways that you can be a conservationist. You can be a lawyer and be a conservationist. You can be a banker and be a conservationist. And it's all about us working together. So for me, that was like, actually, I could be, I could do this, I could do that, I could...
What did you study?
I studied animal behavior and wildlife conservation.
Right.
And sorry, I'm jumping back and forth here, but
no, that's fine.
I think when you tell a lot of people, I think not so much now, but when you tell someone that you want to kind of work in the environmental sector or whatever, it's like, oh, you want to be a vet, or like I used to want to be a zoologist. That was it.
Right.
And so people would say, oh, so you work in a zoo? So you want to work in a zoo? So it's like people just didn't really understand what it was. And so I had to do a lot of like my own research of how to find my path into it, knowing that I had this like purpose. So I had to do a lot of research, obviously going past barriers of like people don't look like me in this sector. So, you know, that for me didn't really hold me back at that point. I think it must have been a subliminal thing, but it wasn't really spoken about back then. It wasn't. You just kind of like get glints of it. Like for example, when I went to university, like being one of maybe two people of color or three people of color in the class. And that's just like progressively, unfortunately, in the next cohort, there was even less. So like, I remember going to university and going, this is a bit odd.
Yeah.
But I think that just, yeah, I just had to keep pushing through the barriers because I just had this like purpose in me. So it was a lot of research, and I did biology, chemistry, Spanish and English literature to start with in A-level. But like you said, I really just struggled with that jump, struggled with so many different other things. And that was when my mental health kind of really came to the surface. My mental health kind of needs a lot of, I had a lot of anxiety back then for different reasons. So yeah, things that I enjoyed in biology in secondary school, I didn't enjoy anymore in sixth form. I remember flipping through the book, looking for the bits about animals.
Right.
And it was like three pages.
Yeah.
And when everyone was doing their projects on like diabetes and stuff, I remember going to my teacher and being like, can I do it on the decline of tigers across the world? And she was like, okay, I guess that's science. But it was just like, yeah, following that kind of path. And I was determined when I was in secondary school to go to Oxford and Cambridge, because I thought that was like, that was the only way to go. That's, you do university, you do that. And especially with the sciences, with zoology as well. But I kind of quickly realized that I wasn't super interested in the molecular side of things. There was so much trial and error. Like I started going, I've always like at that point I was saying, well, I want to be a zoologist. But then I actually looked into it and I was like, I'm not interested in molecular things. I want to see the big stuff. I want to see, like you said, you know, the sexy stuff.
Yeah.
So I decided, yeah, zoology wasn't for me, but I had to do another year, an extra year after those 2 years in sixth form.
Did you have to do those extra years just because of you were struggling? like yeah. with mental health, with anxiety issues.
Yeah, yeah, for a lot of reasons. And just because that, the sixth form that I went to for various reasons just wasn't, it just wasn't suited for me. And for a lot of people there, a lot of people of colour actually, because it was already a secondary school. And then they had a sixth form. So you had a lot of like people who were already there from secondary school, obviously like sixth form normally is. And then the people that were coming in were a lot of like people of colour, to be honest. And so, I don't know, we just like, there was a sort of isolation that went on. But anyway, I won't get into that right now.
That's
but
okay.
Yeah, so there was, it was a combination of a lot of things back then. So I had to, yeah, go back to my old school, which was a super humbling experience. I was so embarrassed. Oh, like, God, you know, yeah. After...
Especially at that age, it just must feel like a failure.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it was like end of the world kind of stuff. Like my friends were going off to university already. I'd done really well in my like GCSE. So to go back and like, yeah, yeah, go back, like I need to do another year, but they were really gracious and let me just, I didn't have to do the 2 years. But yeah, so that enabled me to get into university.
Right.
And
so I'm kind of seeing this thread here of you, you know, having to, you know, be resilient. Mm. And again, in some of the, you know, research that I did on you, you talk about that like quite a lot, you know, there's that being brave. And of course, I think we all have to do that when we have these dreams and of jobs or careers that we want to work in or we have passion for, that you do have to be really brave. And actually often when you get there, it's not how you imagined in your head. You know, we joke a lot about like, you know, the sexy images of the conservationists and the type of work they do. But you also have to do that with these hidden and subtle and also not so subtle barriers of you being a person of color and having that to deal with as well. And like you talked about, like not seeing other people like you once you got onto your course in university. And of course, this industry in whether it's filmmaking, whether it's conservation, whether it's presenting, you know, is a very white industry. And, yeah, you know, and efforts are being made. You know, we're not going to like completely slam it, but growing up and seeing that, those sort of invisible barriers, it that must have been extra hard for you to get your head around, I suppose.
Yeah, 100%. And it was a, like I said, it wasn't, you know, like super like obvious when I was just so focused. Like I was just so focused on like achieving this dream of working with animals. That was my driver. And I'm not saying, you know, that I didn't have like things to overcome. For example, there was like, the reason I picked my university course in Wolverhampton was it was so practical. There were so many hands-on things and they had free trips that you could go on. Went to Everest with a free trip. But there were these trips like South Africa and India that I couldn't go on because I couldn't afford it.
Right.
So it was all like kind of like, you know, bits and bobs, like where you'd see the inequalities. But at the time, I think it wasn't really spoken about.
Right.
It wasn't being dealt with. It wasn't being exposed. So I just kind of...
Yeah, what were your coping strategies and mechanisms? If you're kind of aware, but not aware because it's subtle, like how did you keep going forwards? And, you know, because you ended up getting a first, right?
At
university.
Did.
So,
yes.
You know, it's huge.
I have to say a first with honours because my mum will kill me. She always goes, she's got a first with honours.
I love your mum's your biggest fan, isn't she?
Like, she's my biggest cheerleader. Yeah. She can reel off my CV literally just to anybody and she will, unprovoked. But
that's awesome. So yeah, a first with honours.
A first with honours. But yeah, it was, I think, I guess a part of my purpose is to be, and it should be, I guess it's everyone's, is be the change that you want to see in the world as well. And kind of not knowing that that's what I was particularly doing, like, being a representation, being maybe the first to do a couple, not first like ever, but like the first whatever to do a couple of things. And it's hard because it can be a burden, you know, and it shouldn't have to be that way. But I think it's almost that, it was almost like a silent thing of just keep going, babe. Yeah. Like this is your heart space. So it didn't feel like all of the inequalities, of course they exist and you have to recognize them. And
no, but it's like you have to work twice as hard.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so it's that thing of like, I didn't realize that I was having to necessarily like overcome these barriers, but I was, because yeah, like I said, it wasn't being spoken about, so you didn't really know that maybe you're getting imposter syndrome because you're the only black one in the room. Like you just kind of feel a bit, maybe a little bit uncomfortable, or, you know, I couldn't go on the school trips because actually I wasn't my parent. I was being raised by just my mum, and she couldn't afford to fund those trips.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's just like those things that you don't realize until they're brought to light.
Yeah.
But so because, many things that I had to push through.
Yeah. And when you're younger, you are absorbing those things because kids, you know, have such a strong sense of justice.
Yeah.
Like instinctive. They can't really articulate it, or even like right up until, you know, you're a teenager, or I mean, when you're an adult, it's sometimes hard to articulate. But then, yeah, looking back, of course, now you can, you know, you're able to see that. And actually what I think's great about your story is turning it on its head. And you now do like a lot of advocacy work. You sit on boards of diversity, equity and inclusion and I guess trying to make that pathway, potential pathway for another person of color who was in your situation 10, 15 years ago, hopefully more smooth.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think, because that is one of my missions, is like, I want to fling open the door for the people, the next generations.
Can you tell us a bit about how you actually do that, how you practically do that for people, and hopefully people that will listen to this podcast. And I know one of the things that we've talked about quite a bit and I've talked about on the podcast before is actually just literally seeing you, people seeing you on TV, people's, you know, seeing you on Springwatch, seeing you on CBeebies, you know, that obviously is huge, because then you are a role model and people are, oh, actually I can do that, you know, as well.
Yeah.
But what are the other things that you can do to help other people of color? And I don't just mean you, I mean we, of course, it's everyone's responsibility.
Everyone has a responsibility. But I just find it, yeah, it can be quite like difficult to answer this particular question, because it's just like, or like to talk about it, because it's so multidimensional. And as a black woman myself, it's like a lot of the time in my career, I felt like I'm not doing enough to bring in the next generation to fling open that door. But actually looking and going, just you representing, just you being in the space is doing something. For me, it's about being as transparent as you can about your journey, although it's not always easy, because I'm definitely in like a very much like a self-discovery period. And so I'm questioning a lot. I'm analyzing myself a lot and all these sort of things. And I think for a lot of people it is stuff like this, you know, just hearing other people's stories, taking inspiration from each other in terms of, like, for example, I work with Lyra. People might know as Outside with Lyra. If you don't, please follow her on Instagram. She's incredible. But she was a trainee like me at the Trust. So I started at London Wildlife Trust as a trainee through their Keeping It Wild traineeship, which is an incredible example of how we can increase diversity and inclusion and equity in the sector, because that's exactly why it was created. So we both came through the Keeping It Wild traineeship. I've gone down the presenter route as well. And Lyra is this amazing, like, sort of nature influencer, but just so super real with it. And she's Colombian and she just owns that. She talks about it and she's just real. And that's why people gravitate towards you, is like just being authentic and just, I don't know, doing it for that little girl. Because I think that's what I struggle with. It's like, I've moved around. I was born in Doncaster. Then I moved to Peterborough, and now I live in London. I've lived here most of my life, and it's kind of like I'm still kind of trying to find my identity within all of that. But there is going to be a little girl who is like me, who's moved around to particular places and has like a bit of like a mixed up accent, doesn't really know where to call home and things like that. So I think in terms of bringing in more diversity, one way you can do that is just to think about that person who, there's always going to be someone who's like you, have had similar experiences to you. Is that person that you want to be talking to, and just concentrate on that one person, and it's like a ripple effect. I mean, I don't know if this is making any sense.
No, it does. And I'm also thinking about how, you know, you're talking about it does feel like it kind of weighs on you a bit, this pressure to, because, you know, we're talking about like how you've made it. I mean, you're only just 30, right? And it's not like all the doors are open. You still have to fight to open doors.
Yeah.
And so you have to think about your own career and also how you're going to earn money to live in London. And, you know, as we often talk about, it's just so, it's a brilliant city, but damn expensive.
Yeah.
And then at the same time, feeling responsible, like, oh, I've got to help, like, you know, because I'm like one of the rare black faces in natural history television. I've got this big responsibility. And just to reiterate, it's everybody's responsibility.
It's everybody's responsibility. And least of all, you know, people who are being oppressed by the system. But then a lot of the time it's like forced, more of the pressure is forced onto our shoulders when it shouldn't be.
I know that you've been involved in a few organizations that have sprung up, you know, over the last 4 or 5 years. Can you tell us a little bit about them?
Yeah, sure. So you've got organizations like Flock Together, which I think hopefully listeners know about them, but if you don't, please go and find out about them. So they started off as a birding group for people of color, and founded by Nadim and Ollie, who just kind of like found each other in Hackney through their interest in birding, really organically, really amazingly. They'll tell the story better than I do, so have a research of it.
But are they London specific, or do they do stuff countrywide?
They're from Hackney, but it started off within London, but actually they've got factions now, like in Tokyo, probably elsewhere as well.
Amazing.
So it's really expanded, and I think it's just, I want to say I've been to a walk, Box Hills, Surrey.
Yeah.
I went to Rainham Marshes in Essex, one of the walks.
Brilliant.
So, I mean, it's definitely expanding. I wouldn't be surprised if it's going nationwide. And
so it's kind of taking on an energy of its own.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
And there's an academy as well that they did with London Wildlife Trust. You've also got organisations like Black Girls Hike.
Yeah.
Which is, it's in the name, founded by Rhianne, who's just absolutely incredible and a really good friend.
Brilliant.
And also like London Wildlife Trust, they stepped up to the mantle,
recognised
that there's an issue in the sector, second least diverse after farming in the UK. And so that's how Keeping It Wild was born, by recognising that need and thinking of a solution for it. And that's what brought me into the sector. So for me, that traineeship was life changing. So if one person goes to a Flock Together walk, a Black Girls Hype walk, onto the traineeship, or so many of the other incredible organisations out there, Right to Roam, etc., then hopefully you'll have that hook into nature.
I know that you've already talked about, you didn't really have kind of a penny drop moment of getting into natural history TV presenting, but what was your, did you feel like you had a kind of a break where, hold on a second, I'm actually on TV talking, and what was that? Because obviously now you've done stuff with Springwatch and with the BBC, with Teeny Tinies, but what was your kind of most proud first big moment?
My proudest moment, I guess, to start with, was probably being on Blue Peter. And that was like the first. So I'd been not presenting or doing anything like that previously. But I'd been on television. That was when I was a trainee. And that was within a documentary that Prince William was doing about all the different conservation initiatives around the world. And I actually got to, as one of the trainees, we're just like there at Woodbury Wetlands, which I don't know if you've ever been to Woodbury Wetlands.
Yeah,
it's another
times, yeah.
Under Wildlife Trust reserves. And I passed a moth to Prince William.
That was a pretty big moment.
That was a pretty big moment. I think probably my proudest was, which kind of like started, it was Blue Peter. It was, they contacted to say, we're doing like a little segment about making nature more accessible for young people and just wanting it to be just super simple for them. So I was among like Maya Rose Craig, known as Bird Girl, Indy Green. Basically mine was about, looking up as you go around. So that was probably one of my proudest moments. And my mum filmed that.
I was going to say, was your mum at the moment, your mum was at the front row again.
Yeah, that's the claim. That's her claim to fame, is like, I filmed your Blue Peter piece. And so we were just in the park, real amateur with it. Like, they sent us some kit, but we were doing it with my camera. So we had to self film it. But that's how it sort of started from then.
That's excellent. And then it's just being seen. Did the BBC get in touch about Teeny Tiny Creatures? Because I know I asked you earlier, you don't have an agent, so you're doing most of this stuff off your own back at the moment, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So I mean, so I always kind of get the journey mixed up. So it was Blue Peter, I think at the time I was, Springwatch had contacted, a researcher from Springwatch had contacted on Twitter, and that was to do with the Great North Wood project that I was on previously with London Wildlife Trust.
I mean, that must have been such a great moment for you. Was it a pinch yourself moment, or was it also just you didn't have time for that because you had so much anxiety, like, oh my God, I'm on Springwatch? Or was it just a whirlwind?
It was a bit of a whirlwind, but to be honest, like, I just had to kind of remind myself, yeah, this is huge. And I had a lot of anxiety at the time, but like, it really helped that we had like a really small team. It was nice. Me, a producer, and a cameraman. Just obviously, I love them to bits because I've done the previous things with them as well with Springwatch. I wasn't personally watching Springwatch.
It's
at
so
the time.
Funny that, isn't it? I mean, I don't actually end up watching a lot of wildlife documentaries. Yeah. I don't know about you. It's so weird.
It's so weird because back in the day, I was all about it, like so immersed in documentaries. And I think when you get into the sector yourself, I guess it's similar to so many other people. Yeah, I don't watch so many documentaries anymore. Yeah. So I wasn't.
Or
actually,
like musicians that don't listen to music at home.
Yeah, you know,
exactly.
But I knew Springwatch was huge. Like, I knew it was like this amazing platform that had been going on for years. That, you know, is so many people's connection to nature within a home. So it was just like, oh my gosh, I'm going to be on Springwatch. What the actual heck? So it was like a huge moment. And I just felt so kind of honored to be the voice, especially for the Great North Wood project that has my absolute heart. But yeah, that kind of then took off from there. And it's all about, it's just so funny how life works and how the industry works as well. And I always say to people, you just never know who's saying your name in the room, or what video someone's playing of yours. Like, so just even if you're just doing something that you think only one person's watching, try and do your best.
Yeah,
like,
I think that's such good advice. Watching. You're right. You never know who's watching. Yeah. I mean, it's so funny. Like, I'm, you know, I joke now that I'm trying to move away from foxes. I've been working with foxes for 7 years. Obviously, I've done this book, and, you know, we talked about it at the Natural History Museum together. And, you know, I filmed with the BBC, and then last year, a German production company got in touch and saw what I'd done with the BBC, and they wanted to do something similar. I just finished filming that in January of this year. And then, funnily enough, last week I got an email from Springwatch, and I'm just like, oh my God,
oh my,
you know, here we go. Like, they want to do bloody foxes again.
You're the fox guy now.
I know.
That's what happens within, like,
yeah,
I think, like, the environmental sphere, isn't it? It's like, you get like, it's like, what's your expertise?
Yeah, exactly.
And actually, that's something that I do struggle with, because I feel like my connection isn't necessarily that I'm just like this kind of girl. I mean, to be honest, I'm very much a tree girl.
Yeah.
But like, it's like that jack of all trades kind of thing.
Yeah.
But,
which I think also at the stage of your career is like completely fine.
Yeah.
Or at any time. It's because it's variety as well.
Absolutely.
Which is
great.
Yeah.
Knowing that Springwatch was just like this huge moment. It was absolutely amazing. But yeah, like, it's just funny how life works, because at the same time, after the Blue Peter, the producer from that then sort of thought about me for Teeny Tiny Creatures, because originally it was being presented by Rory and Fern Corrigan. So Rory Crawford and Fern Corrigan, but Fern decided she wanted to go behind the camera. I think she set up her own production company now.
Great. So there was an opening.
There was an opening, basically. And it was just funny. Like, so many people I've spoken to after the fact, because Rory was going, I'd seen you on Instagram and things, and I was putting your name forward. I didn't even know him at this time. The producer from Blue Peter was putting my name forward. And so it was just like, you just never know. And I didn't know these people. So when I got this call, when I was leading a volunteer day, when I used to work on the Great North Wood project, and I was like in the woods, in Dulwich Woods, and this wee Scottish lady, because it's BBC Scotland,
right?
That producer was on the other end of the line going, we've got this Teeny Tiny Creatures show, and we've seen what you've done with Blue Peter, etc. Would you like to give it a go? And it was just, that was so much of like a pinching moment, because I was like, oh my God, what the heck? And I just think the journey that it's taken me on has just been so incredible. Like, I've seen so much more of the UK. I've met so many incredible people,
right,
working with Rory, for example, and that's been, it's just added like an extra layer of magic to being in the wildlife conservation sector.
And what I love hearing about is that, you know, you are a presenter, but it's quite clear that that's not your like 100% you know, focus and full-time thing, because underneath it, you've had these great jobs working at the Great North Wood with the London Wildlife Trust. That was a 2-year project that's come to an end. And now you're doing
it was a 6-year
six-year project. Yeah. I'm so sorry.
No, it's okay. No, yeah,
but were you involved for that for six years?
I was involved about coming up to 3 years. I think it was.
Oh, wow.
No, actually, coming up to 4 years.
Right.
Yeah, about 3.5 years.
And so, but you now have this new role with the London Wildlife Trust, and, you know, it's slightly different, but also equally as exciting. It's an amazing thing that you're doing. Can you tell us a little bit about that, where you're at with it, you know, how long it's got to run?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
It is an incredible, incredible project. It's a pilot project, and it's a partnership between London Wildlife Trust and NHS East London Foundation Trust via CAM, so which is the Child Adolescent Mental Health Services, which is nationwide, but this is Newham specific. They're basically funding a 2-year project, and it sort of sits in like the green prescribing, social prescribing area of things, which is quite a big thing at the moment. I guess it's gaining more traction, where instead of, you know, being perhaps prescribed medication, they might go and volunteer, which sounds really basic. It's not just that.
No, but I think so much of you know, especially with the pandemic, putting it into sharp focus, like that connection with nature is so important for our mental health.
Exactly. Yeah. So this sits with that bit. It's with young people. So post-COVID, there's been a massive boom, as we all know, within the mental health crisis.
Yeah.
And I think it was a 30% increase in the cases of 5 to 17 year olds that were coming through, but they were on the, so you've got different pathways. So you've different levels. So you've got the red, more extreme cases, you've got amber, and then green, which is kind of like the lower risk pathways. And they call it the green pathway. So because of that boom, the lower risk categories were having to wait so much longer to be seen.
Right.
So this concept of waiting well came in, and Newham put together something called the Newham Multi-Agency Collective. So the incredible project that I work on is called Nature in Mind, which is a partnership between the East London Foundation Trust, NHS, via their CAMS, Newham CAMS in particular. And CAMS stands for Child Adolescent Mental Health Services. And it's a pilot project, which basically is to support young people who are coming through the Child Adolescent Mental Health Services who are having to wait a very, very long time as a result of different factors, but mainly because of the boom in mental health cases post-COVID.
Right.
As we know, we're in like a mental health crisis at the moment. And so the lower risk pathways, as opposed to the amber and the red, obviously, they're having to wait a lot longer to be seen because they're less at risk per se. But so this kind of concept of waiting well came in, and Newham put together something called the Multi-Agency Collective. And what there basically is a bunch of partners across Newham, different organisations. So you've got like Premier Kicks, which does football, Caramel Rock, which does, they do fashion. You've got East London Dance. So just loads of partners, loads of different activities that young people can get involved on. And we meet every Wednesday. The children are sort of referred through. And
do they get to kind of choose what they like the interest in what they would like to partake in.
Yeah. So beforehand, they've already kind of had like a sort of triage, found out what their interests are. And of course, like giving them the range of this is what it is, this is what we can offer. And so they kind of pick their interests. But of course, as you probably would guess, there's not a lot of like traction for nature-based sort of therapies.
Interesting.
And so it's a pilot project, a real test bed for kind of going into that like green prescribing, social prescribing area.
Yeah.
And using nature as like a vehicle for all the benefits that it can provide for mental health, especially for young people.
That sounds brilliant.
And it's, yeah. So we, I coordinate the project, and I also deliver it as well with support of the learning engagement team as well at London Wildlife Trust. And at each of the sessions, we also have a art psychotherapist from the NHS, CAMS. Wow. And so the sessions are, we do programs for 5 to 11 year olds, and we do programs for 11 to 17 year olds that have been referred through CAMS. And it's just, it's been so amazing to to be a part of it, because I've had to, I was going into a different, like a different sort of area, but so I'm learning so many new things, but just seeing the difference that it makes to the littlies, that can we call the 5 to 11 year olds littlies and the 11 to 17 year olds oldies. So yeah, it's just amazing to see how simply nature can just help through play, through doing walks, bat walks, doing arts and crafts. We did one yesterday actually with the older group, and we started off and we just did like a scavenger hunt. Then we went inside because it was absolutely like pouring down with rain, and like most of the time we'll brave it. They were pretty good in the scavenger hunt, but yeah, we went upstairs into the terrace and you can see around Walthamstow Wetlands, because that's where we deliver.
That's brilliant.
At one of our London Wildlife Trusts, and we were just doing arts and crafts in there and games, and yeah, just seeing how people are starting to recognise the well-being benefits that nature gives us.
Yeah,
it's incredible.
Sure. I mean, I guess it's in a way meant easy for people like you and me to say, yeah, well, of course.
Mm.
But for people that don't have that access, or for people that are struggling with mental health, it's incredible and profound the effect that just, I mean, you hear stories of people just walking into a forest, for example, and your blood pressure drops.
Yeah. You know, Shinrin-yoku, the forest bathing.
Yes.
All of that. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And it just, yeah, of course, it makes total sense. So, I mean, I think it's amazing what you do. Like you're full of so much energy, and like, you know, this is a part-time role. You've got all of your presenting going on, like, outside of this. I mean, you've talked about doing poetry. You've obviously got like huge amount of like creative outlets, but are you good? I mean, I know you said you struggle with mental health issues, but are you good at like giving yourself a bit of a break and taking time off and, you know, just having nothing to do with your career? Like what other kind of stuff are you interested in doing outside of this?
Well, it's funny you say that. Do you give yourself a break? Because I went from doing full-time, so my first position with London Wildlife Trust was Great North Wood, and I purposely wanted to go part-time with this new project because I wanted to give myself more time for my mental health, and also just in...
Oh, that's me. Sorry.
It's all right.
I should have my phone off. What's going on here?
Oh. Need to get it.
No,
please feel free.
It's fine. By the way, I was going to say, anytime you're like, you want to stop and start again, and I keep saying, don't worry about it. Just remember, I'm the one that kicked the fucking thing over, which lost us 20 minutes.
Fine.
When you took this second role, you were conscious that you wanted to make it a part-time role to have some more time for yourself.
Yeah, exactly. So I had more time for myself and also just more headspace. And I think something that's come out of, you know, COVID is recognizing that everyone's got different capacities. And that's not just to do with mental health. That's just lifestyle. Like I don't actually like want to be working flat out for like most of the week. I don't want to be burnt out. So I was really burnt out. And so that was my decision of like, yes, I will take this role, but it has to be part-time. And so, yeah, it was, I was really blessed that it was part-time. But yeah, I mean, outside of, doing all of that sort of business, I roller skate.
Awesome.
I roller skate, but that's, I mean, that feels like therapy to me, roller skating. Like I can hardly do all these tricks. Like I've been,
can you roller skate backwards?
Very, very slowly. I have to do it in kind of like this. I was taught like almost like a backward salsa. So yeah, very, very slowly. But for me, it's just
that's
like,
the test of a good roller skater, isn't it?
If you can go backwards, like that's definitely they do like speed skating in roller skating rings. I don't know if you've ever been, and it's like terrifying. So that's like, if I can do that one day, that I'll know I'm a real roller skater. But no, it's just, for me, it just is the freedom of it. It feels like you're flying.
Awesome.
When you're just like roller skating through. So I roller skate. I'm trying to get back into my poetry, as I said, using that as just
learning a language.
Learning a language. Yeah. Obsessed with Duolingo. We just... We had this conversation with Matt's partner. I'm now on Super Duolingo, thanks to her. Learning a language. So yeah, I mean, that's been really important for me. And that's another thing that was sat in my heart when I was younger, was like, I've always loved languages.
Yeah.
And if my partner's that can, like, if I meet someone who can speak like multiple languages really sexy to me, I'm like, yes, absolutely.
I'm really in awe of that. You know?
Yeah,
English people are rubbish. I mean, it's partly I used to kind of be sort of really apologetic about it, but it is the international language. And I'm sure if German or French was, probably there's a good chance we'd be speaking that as well.
True.
I mean, maybe not now, but you know what I mean? So, but yeah, I think just having that, is second language is such a great asset. Good for the mind and like, culturally and just so important.
For real, yeah. So that was...
that sounds great. That sounds really amazing. Good. But, we talked about this a little bit earlier and I can say this from having had the luxury of like throughout all my 20s and 30s, I did so much traveling. I'm so lucky. Mm. But now I do have my heart like really set on London and London wildlife and telling local stories. But, you know, you've gone into that straight away, but, you know, seemingly with this like lots of energy. And it's not just about, you know, your presenting career, mm-hmm. but it's also like you've just talked about helping kids, you know, with mental health issues and engaging them with nature. But like your personal, like, and I guess also you're growing up in a time where, you know, like air travel is frowned upon.
Right? Yes. Oh my goodness. The guilt.
So you can't go gallivanting around the world. You know, you want to go and see jaguars in the Pantanal mm-hmm. or whatever. But do you have like ambitions to do work abroad or to travel, somehow environmentally, in an environmentally friendly way? What are your kind of hopes, wishes and dreams for the future?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to be honest, like I do fly, but it's that conscious thing of being like, oh my gosh, I just feel really guilty about it. But I think, you know, that's a wider conversation about, you know, I don't know, everyone not having to do all the same.
Yeah, and Marcus Westberg, who's been on this podcast, he just said like, you know, I asked him about flying because he flies a lot for his work. And he's right, you know, like guilt is a pretty pointless emotion to have. If what you're doing as a consequence of flying is helping and contributing, then
it's very nuanced. It's very it's multidimensional.
Absolutely, this is the theme of the day.
But yeah, I do have like when I was younger, that was a thing. I was like, I am going to South America, to Africa, and I think actually, learning Spanish, I've always said like I don't know why, but I've always just had like this love for the language, because I actually they didn't teach it in secondary school. They were teaching French and German, and I was like, I really want to learn Spanish. And so I got a private tutor outside of school and then did the GCSE privately. So I feel like somewhere down the line, maybe I'm gonna go to South America and do something amazing there, and I'm gonna go, that's why Spanish came into it. But yeah, I do like still have those like dreams of going across. I really want to see orangutans in Borneo. Want to like volunteer and do all of that kind of stuff for sure. But it is, thinking about it, how I can do it in a very mentally friendly way. And I think it just adds, I think getting to know the wildlife on your doorstep just adds to the richness of nature as a whole. Knowing that, yes, in my like ancestral homes, like Africa and the Caribbean, like, you know, we have these amazing, like beautiful, exotic animals. But actually, in the UK, we've got a lot to also to do here.
Yeah. I mean, I think I couldn't kind of agree more. I think when I was younger, I just all of, you know, it was about, you want to go and see wildlife? Okay, you got to go to East Africa or South America. But actually, like being one of the most nature depleted countries in Europe and on Earth, actually, it needs us.
Exactly.
It needs us.
Yeah. And there's conservationists across the world that are already doing it. You know, we spoke when I first, when we met and we did the interview, you were saying that you kind of took a bit of like a step back from going, like you just said, you know, going over to other countries and doing photography there, because you were like, there's already amazing photographers from those countries are already doing it. And it's like, how about we just focus on our own patch? You know, like there's no point in us going to other countries and trying to dictate what they should do. So I think, that's another aspect of just being like, do we need another person going over and volunteering? Like, that's in mind. But of course, like, you know, like Africa, like I said, in the Caribbean, they're our ancestral homes. So it's like, I definitely want to experience that for sure.
That's awesome. And also what I love about you doing London, you know, London focused work and London focused projects is also, and we, you know, again, going back to that joke about the North South divide, like I've never been to the Great Northwood, for example. I'll definitely come and visit.
Yes. I'll give you a tour.
Awesome. that's so great. And just, it's just such a good example of like, not just you know, we talk obviously about photography a lot on this podcast, and that narrative has got stronger and stronger over the years about photographing your local patch, but it's also doing what you do. And I think, you know, perhaps this is a good message for younger people who want to get into presenting, is like, yeah, look, you know, you're a really good role model, not only for, you know, other people of color, but also for doing stuff on your doorstep. There are opportunities out there. One of the things, I'm just going to pull this up, which I loved, that you said in your Chester presentation. Yeah, one of the things that you said quite a lot, and when I was doing the research, was like, your uniqueness is your superpower.
Yes,
I love that. And again, going back to being brave and going for those things. And I think, yeah, don't be put off by, yeah, oh, you know, London's boring, or, you know, you hardly ever see anything, just birds. You know, there's so many
from the truth.
Yeah, there's so much good stuff going on here. There's so many good people. You know, think about Kabir, who I interviewed last time. Yeah. There's people really fighting for really, really good projects.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of, quote unquote, ordinary people doing extraordinary things. That's like my, I'll say, yeah, it's like one of my favorite sayings as well, because, there is, look around, you know, like, a lot of people think it's just a concrete jungle, but it's not. There's like in the cracks of the pavements, there's life coming through, and there's so many different ways to connect as well that are here, like you said, on our doorstep. So
yeah, and then we have to learn to love what's on our doorstep if we're going to love anything, like at all, like what's around us. Let's not ignore that.
Yeah, and it also, like, it's a deeper message as well, because it comes back to that mental health thing. You know, when I was starting this project, the Nature in Mind. At that point, I was trying to focus on my own mental health, and it kind of went into my head. I was like, how am I going to help support other people's mental health when mine's in the drain, basically? So I had that real moment, and it's like, you have to really start with yourself. You have to know what helps you when you go into nature, what helps your mental health, so then you can pass it on, because there's no point in, like, you know, going elsewhere, looking elsewhere. It has to be a very personal thing. So I guess it's that thing of like, yeah, be the change that you want to see, look in the mirror first, and yeah, it starts with us. It starts with, like, sorting ourselves out first, or sorting out our patch first, and then going wider and just, like, yeah, rippling through.
Beautifully put. We're going to slowly come to an end.
Sure.
I did have a question, because I put some questions out and someone got back. Ooh. And someone got back to me. It's their daughter, a young girl called Anna, who's 12, who just quite simply asked, what's your favorite animal and why?
Oh my goodness. I don't know why, but that makes you want to cry. It makes me want to cry because it's just, yeah, I think one thing, Anna, I'm going to answer your question. One thing that I love about everything that I do is just, like, what reminds me of the why is when you get, like, 12-year-olds, like, asking questions like that. But yeah, sorry. What's my favorite animal and why? Oh, Anna, what a question. I get asked this question all the time, and I'm going to say that I don't have a favorite animal. It changes minute to minute, hour by hour, with everything that I, you know, all the stuff that you learn.
Well, I'll add to Anna's question. And what's your favorite animal now?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I was going to say, yeah. So actually, I'm going to say one of my favorite animals at the moment is the red kite. And that's a bird of prey.
Beautiful and animal.
Absolutely beautiful. And they keep, and the reason it's like one of my favorites at the moment is I keep getting glances of them. And Anna, red kites are
where you
huge.
Live.
Yeah.
Oh, awesome.
Flying over, or just even, I was in Ealing actually the other day. Ealing's an amazing hotspot for wildlife. Got the Ealing Wildlife Group there. Shout out to
And that's
to
where they've just
Sean
released beavers.
McCormack. Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
Amazing.
So yeah, we had them in Ealing, but they just, and every time I see an animal consistently, I kind of think, oh, is that, like, I look it up and I go, spirit animal, totem animal, what's it saying? All that sort of stuff. But also there's a connection. They're such an amazing success story because they were sort of like driven to the brink of extinction. And when I was in university, I was really lucky because I got to go to Aberystwyth and see them being fed. And that's kind of like one of the ways that the community has helped them recover is by doing these feeding stations.
Yeah, and it's a great conservation success story, isn't
exactly.
it? The red kite.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, that is one of my favorites at the moment because they are absolutely majestic. They're gorgeous and really recognizable as well, I would say. If you're ever trying to, like me, pin down birds of prey, especially in flight, it's quite difficult.
Yeah, it's a challenge,
but
isn't it?
Red kite, that fork tail, is like a dead giveaway. So, yes, Anna, thank you so much for your question.
that's brilliant. No, it's a great answer. That's so good. Well, look, I've just had a brilliant time the whole day. It's been so much fun.
It's been an experience. It hasn't just been the podcast, and it's been a whole experience. Highly recommend. 5 stars.
Thank you so much. Yeah, that's right. We need to get this, you know, spread this podcast far and wide.
Absolutely.
And actually, I started, because I've been running this podcast nearly 8 years.
Incredible.
Which has been great. And you know, I mean, I feel so lucky meeting people like you and all my other great guests. Mm. And I'm going to do a shameless plug now, because
do it.
I started a Patreon page because, you know, for many years I did wonder, like, you know, how do I monetize this? You know, we've talked about that, you know, not working for free.
Yep.
And yeah, it was always going to be really difficult. It would have to have been my full-time thing. And even then it's really, really challenging trying to make money out of podcasts and markets so saturated. So actually I was inspired by Blind Boy, because most of his revenue, and it is his full-time thing, comes from donations from Patreon. So $5 a month, price of a coffee.
Yeah.
And you can support it. You don't have to.
Yeah.
People can still listen for free, but it obviously a little goes a long way.
Absolutely.
It's going to help me bring more wonderful people like Chantel on the podcast. So
thank you very much.
Yeah.
And I think when you don't know about like what goes into podcasting, you might think, oh, why does it need to be like paid for? But actually look at all the kit that you've got here. Like, you know, you've got the whole home studio here. You've had to like put a lot of effort into this, all the editing that you have to, it's time and, you know, to platform people and do all of that. So yeah, absolutely.
Well, I really appreciate that. And by the way, I did not tell Chantel to say that. This is
I'm a paid actor.
Fully authentic. Well, look, it's been so much fun talking with you. And I can't wait to see, you know, how your rich career, you know, at the tender age of 30 is, you know, going to unravel over the next 10 years. And I'd love to get you back on again. And yeah, good luck with everything.
Thank you so much, Matt, for having me, honestly. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Chantel. You know, sometimes I forget and often just look up to people who are on the telly. I think that's just a real childhood thing. You know, we think they've got all their shit together without fully considering what they may be going through or feeling. So it's really good to hear it straight. And big thanks again to Chantel. What a star. Please follow her on Instagram @ChantelNature. I'll put that link up in her podcast page in the podcast section of my website. You can check out all the links, and that will include many of the organizations that we talked about. So share them and follow Chantel on her journey. She is a brilliant presenter and all-around nature lover and enthusiast. Just spending a few hours of her over at Highgate Cemetery and in a local park, it was just, you could really see that just coming through. What a great person. Yeah, and please continue to share this podcast. Support it on the Patreon page. Tell a friend. Can never stop getting it out there enough. There are so many out there, so you've got to try and rise above the noise. Thanks again for listening. See you next time.